This is All Things Considered on Vermont Public Radio. I'm Neil Charnoff with VPR News. Governor Peter Shumlin won't tell lawmakers or the public how he plans to pay for single-payer health care until next year, but some legislators are already pondering alternatives to the governor's plan. And a private memo obtained by VPR is helping to shine a light on this behind-the-scenes legislative process. VPR's Peter Hirschfeld has more.
It's only 3.5 pages long, and it's much more of a conceptual outline than a fully formed plan. But the March 24th memo, authored by a policy analyst hired by the legislature, shows that at least some lawmakers are already considering alternatives to whatever proposal Peter Shumlin drops on their desks next year.
You know, I have always expected that there will be alternative provisions that are put on the table, and they will stand on their own merit. I think that the governor's responsibility is going to be to show that what he puts on the table makes the most sense.
House Speaker Shap Smith says he hasn't seen the document in question, but Smith says it doesn't surprise him that members of the House and Senate are looking at alternatives to the approximately $2 billion public financing plan Shumlin says is needed to replace the premium-based model in place now. The document was written by Ken Thorpe, who was hired in January to provide expert advice to members of the legislature. And it differs from the vision touted by Shumlin in two fundamental ways. It doesn't create a single universal insurance plan, and it doesn't rely on the multi-billion dollar tax structure Shumlin wants to use. Thorpe is working on other concepts. He didn't respond to requests for comment. Chittenden Senator Tim Ash is the Democratic Progressive Chairman of the Senate Committee on Finance. Ash says that since lawmakers passed legislation in 2011 that put the state on a path towards single payer, many elected officials have come to better understand the difficulties involved.
The legislature knew that there were multiple ways to achieve the goals and said, administration, you come up with the best mechanism to make sure we have all those goals met. It's 3 years later, and the administration has been working on it. They're finding that it's more challenging, perhaps, than they thought when we set out on this journey 3 years ago.
Ash says the baseline goals enshrined in the single-payer law, called Act 48, are that all Vermonters will have health insurance, that the health insurance will be comprehensive, and that it will be financed in a fair and equitable way. And Ash says there are multiple routes the legislature could take to achieve those goals.
But in the end, when the administration presents a plan, I think the conversation will be, is that the only way to deliver universal health care, decent benefits, affordable price, or are there other mechanisms? And what are the relative benefits and costs of taking these different approaches?
House Speaker Smith says the work being done by legislators now is part of a process to ensure the best possible health care reform plan for Vermonters next year.
I don't think that it's a bad thing to push the administration and the governor to put something on the table that will work better than what the alternatives are.
Thorpe's contract runs through the end of the legislative session. Smith says the legislature may decide to extend his contract through the off session as well. For VPR News, I'm Peter Hirschfeld in Montpelier.
Vermont is poised to become the first state in the country to require the labeling of food products made with genetically modified organisms. After nearly 2 hours of debate, a strong bipartisan coalition of senators gave their preliminary approval to the bill by a vote of 26-2. VPR's Bob Kinzel reports.
Under the bill, the labeling requirements would go into place in July of 2016 and would affect virtually all food products sold in Vermont. Backers of the plan, like Windsor Senator Dick McCormick, said the legislation was not an indictment of the science of genetic engineering. Instead, he described the bill as a basic consumer right-to-know issue.
The question that this bill addresses is not the safety or danger of genetically modified organisms. In any case, the question the bill addresses is the right to know.
Caledonia Senator Joe Benning told his colleagues that he often inspects food labels to learn about their carbohydrate levels. Benning says he does this because he has a much easier time losing weight when he restricts his intake of carb-heavy foods.
So the question for me, Mr. President, is, do I have the right to deny them the ability to look at a label the same way I do for carbohydrates and determine whether or not there is something in there that might or might not affect how their body might react? And I believe the answer is yes.
Two other New England states, Maine and Connecticut, have passed GMO labeling bills. But these laws don't go into effect until a number of other states have enacted similar legislation. This has been done in part as a way to share legal fees if the laws are challenged in court. The Senate bill doesn't need the approval of any other state before becoming law. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Dick Sears thinks Vermont will be in good shape if it's sued.
We felt that the bill that we're presenting today to the Vermont Senate is defensible, number one. Number two, we felt that a trigger of some future date and relying on other states was not in our best interest, that it was in our best interest to go forward and hope that other states would follow Vermont.
One of the two dissenting votes came from Franklin Senator Norm McAllister, who is a former dairy farmer. McAllister says he's used a variety of GMO products over the years and never had any problems. He thinks some backers of the bill have misled the public about possible health concerns associated with the use of GMOs.
This is the misinformation that the public has had. Even in our public hearing, we heard from people who were making statements that we even knew were incorrect. It was a scare tactic as far as I'm concerned, and that's why I don't support it.
Because the Senate bill is similar to legislation passed by the House last year, it's possible that House leaders will accept the Senate version and then send the bill to the governor. Or they might ask for a conference committee to negotiate some of their differences with the Senate bill. For VPR News, I'm Bob Kinzel in Montpelier.
And finally this evening, the Vermont Division of Emergency Management and Homeland Security is activating its entire staff at 7 this evening to monitor flooding and other weather-related emergencies across the state. Melting snow combined with today's heavy rain has led to some flooding, and rivers are expected to rise overnight. It's All Things Considered on Vermont Public Radio. Rather than dreading mud season, commentator Martha Molnar looks forward to it.
We moved to Vermont at the end of June 6 years ago and enjoyed every hour of the sublime summer, followed by a glorious fall and a very long white winter. After that, it was no longer beautiful. It was, in fact, devoid of any hint of loveliness, unless one was a newt whose future was tied to mud. I had heard plenty about Vermont's infamous mud season, but I had no clear understanding of just how long a drippy day can be, not to mention a week of such days, nor of what it's like driving on a dirt road that in mud season demanded skills I didn't possess. And yet, after the first year's learning curve, I found myself looking forward to rain, cold, and mud. Seriously. I'm what you might call a foul weather worker, since anything but the grimmest weather gives me multiple excuses to shun responsibilities. So for getting serious work done, mud season is a gift. Spring and summer present multiple gardening activities, not to mention the lure of swimming, biking, kayaking, and just plain lying around in the warmth. I try to do my writing assignments outdoors, and I can tell you that those ads featuring some high-achieving person perched at the edge of a cliff, laptop in lap, and a breathtaking panorama below are patently false. Computer screens just glare at you outdoors, forcing you to abandon either the outdoors or the laptop. And since I always choose to abandon the laptop, I get little writing done in spring or summer. Fall brings even more gorgeous days. Spending time indoors while the world blazes away seems downright ungrateful for the bounty of beauty. Winter, with its short, cold days, should make the indoors attractive. But here's the catch. Precisely because the days are so short, I feel compelled to take advantage of the light, to make tracks in fresh snow, to study the crisscrossing animal prints, to ski the fields and mountains. Afterwards, too tired to work, I catch up on the reading that has piled up during the previous 3 seasons. Then, finally, we get a string of days when the snow is gone and the clouds hang so low that the gray earth blends into the sky, when the seed packets lined up in the kitchen are still only eye candy, when even the robins huddle out of sight, ignoring the worms in the sodden lawn, and each step to the mailbox is accompanied by disgusting sucking sounds. On days like this, when the outdoor ceases to call, the foul weather worker that's me gets going. I rise early and work diligently through lunch and past dinner. So much to do before the mud dries. So imagine my disappointment at the virtual absence of mud last year and my cheerful expectations for a record mud season this year. Expectations that are being met, and then some.